rest of us, I don't care if you flip, swipe, tag, drop, upload, download, go to Acts 17, beginning in verse 16. As our message for today takes us through Paul's second missionary journey. Now, what I love about Paul is that he never signed up for any of this. He was just a guy that wanted to know God. He felt he had it all together. He had a nice, neat, tidy little box with a beautiful bow on top, and all of a sudden, Jesus Christ comes along and blows that out of the water. And grace has a funny way of doing that. You see, for Paul, it was about what you did. He really believed in his heart of hearts that sinful actions made a sinful person. And therefore, he became a Jew of such righteousness, such holiness, that he might earn and appease his God. But then Jesus comes. And he blows it all out of the water. And he brings a new philosophy, a new thought. And it goes something like this. What if it's not the sinful action that makes us sinful, but rather that we are in fact sinful people? That we can't even live up to our own desires of our own hearts and minds. That the values and virtues that we find so near and dear to each one of us, we can't even uphold all the time. Therefore, we fall short, not just of ourselves, but of something far greater, the glory and holiness of God. And so what Paul will come to realize is that we are all sinful, meaning that we all fall short of the glory of God, and that's important because when Christ comes, he does not. As Christ comes to the earth, he wraps himself in flesh, and he is both the very Son of God, and he is both the Son of humanity. And that's important. Because theologically, in order to become the ultimate in sacrifice to appease a holy God, he has to be born of the flesh and born of the Spirit. He has to be able to walk a mile in our shoes and be able to have every temptation, every struggle, every frustration, every injustice presented to him so that he can be found holy. Because not once in his entire life here on earth does he fall short of absolute perfect obedience to the Father. And he does that for one reason, not so that he can toit around saying, I am the greatest of all things, worship and bow before me. He does it so he can say, look, I made these sacrifices for you. You don't owe me anything for it. I did it because I love you. Because back in the very beginning, before time even began, I was there with my Father, myself, and the Holy Spirit wrapped up in this beautiful dance, this perfect relationship. We were satisfied beyond belief. But it dawned on us that this love we have between one another is so great, we've got to share it. And so we created humanity in our image. We gave them all the stuff in the universe, everything they needed and more. But we also knew that if we were to give them this amazing love, we would give them choice. For love can never be a manipulation. And in doing so, we gave them the choice, knowing full well that they would probably choose to not love us. But we would not give up on them. And so a holy triune God, three in one, a unique idea to even uphold that three distinct persons live in one being of God would come to not only bring creation but to satisfy the falling short of that creation. That even though they chose a different life, God would not allow that to be the end all be all. There's always hope with God. And so he sends his Son. In perfect obedience, lives a life holy unto God so that when he dies, he can give himself as a ransom for all of us. That when he's on the cross, the full wrath of God is poured out on him in such a way that it is truly finished forever. God has nothing left, nothing stored up for us. What would it be like to live our lives as if there was nothing negative stored up for us from God? I mean, that would be absolute freedom. Then if that wasn't enough, Christ dies and then is resurrected as if to be proven to us. As if again to say, the wrath that you saw poured out on me on the cross truly was satisfied because look, my Father has brought me back from the dead Death can no longer hold me. Sin is no longer a barrier. Freedom is available not just to me, but to all. And anyone who trusts the original idea of God, being that God would be our God and we would be his people, the original promise God made to humanity, that I would provide a way for you to return home to me. Anyone that looks upon Christ and says, thank you. I know I'm not enough, but you are enough. Gets to be a part of a life-changing gift. Now the hard part is, as Paul quickly finds out, that once you accept Christ, yes, your life is truly changed, but then, boy, the next day happens. And that guy cuts you off. The internet goes down at work. Your cell phone battery dies. You and your wife, or you and your husband, get in an argument. Your children aren't obeying. And life happens. The world knows this. But what happens is we somehow get ourselves caught back up in this agnostic belief system that Paul's about to undo. And we start looking at the sinful things that we get ourselves caught up in, and we go, oh my gosh, Christ, I'm just not good enough. I can't do it. I'm supposed to be born again. I'm supposed to be a new creation. I'm supposed to be your son and your daughter. I'm supposed to be transformed. But I'm still angry, hurt, upset. I'm dealing with past issues and wounds. I'm still wrestling with addictions and ways that I self-medicate my life. I'm still trying to be my own God. And we're left with two options. One option is to simply say, Jesus, you're still enough. And there's nothing I can say or do that will separate your love from me. Paul will talk about that to the Roman church. There is nothing you can say or do that will separate you from God's love. Or what many of us do, myself included, is, well, screw it. I can't do it. I'm out. I'm either all in or I'm not in. I'm a man of passion. Values. Go big, go home. And that's a horrible view. And I share that with you because I do wrestle with that view. And it's worse when you're a pastor. Because now you have this ordination. I mean, even the IRS thinks I should be better. So what do? Where do we go? Well, I'm going to challenge you with a story that's going to be shared to us by Luke in the adventures of Paul as he journeys on his second missionary journey. This man has all of about 25 minutes experience under his belt, and he is now going to a new area, a new place in the world, where the same thoughts and the same belief systems we struggle with in our world today not only are prevalent, but that's where they were birthed. These people hold fast to tradition, and so do we. And Paul is about to bring a message of hope that is going to revolutionize the world as we know it. But like all hope, it's a gift. Some will accept it, some will not. If you have your Bibles, go to Acts chapter 17, beginning in verse 16. And here Luke is going to begin to show us the gospel and how it matches up against two major opponents. So far, we have watched as Paul has wrestled with the zealous Jews and getting them to release themselves of this law junk, this I have to match up, I have to be Christ before I can accept Christ. I have to be perfect before I can allow him to be perfect for me. And we do that in church, don't we? Have you ever blown it during the week, or worse, Saturday night, and then Sunday morning comes and it's like, oh my God, I can't go to church with what I did last night. It's that same idea. But we're going to find that that's irrelevant. It's irrelevant because what you did, what you thought, how you acted, cannot, will not, no way, no how, put Christ back on that cross, because it is finished. It was finished then, it is finished now, and thank God for the Greek language. It tells us with their verbs that it will never cease being finished. So as Paul moves on from the Jews, he now hits a second group. Moving from Turkey to Greece, he now comes into some economic and political forces of the Roman Empire and what it is to have a true ruler and a God in your life. For these people are constantly badgered with the new Caesar that comes into power. And then the next Caesar, who killed the first Caesar, is now in power. And then that Caesar killed the other Caesar and probably was in the plot to kill the first Caesar, and so the politics are a mess. But each time they're to worship these Caesars and allow their lives to be led and wholly governed by these people, these gods, whose values and virtues do nothing more than seek their own pleasures. The people in the Middle East are curious and wondering, is there something more? As we look around our world, are we not curious and do we not wonder, is there something more to living in the world the way the world wants us to live? Do we have to lie, cheat, and steal? Or is there another way? During this part, we're also going to see how Luke points out that now that Paul has done such great battle in all these areas, he's now going to tackle the most complicated area, the area of philosophy, which is a constant bed of shifting sand. I remember my first philosophy class. Our professor told us that he got a D+ and his PhD to become a philosophy professor. However, the D+ was passing, and therefore he has a PhD, and you will call him Dr. So-and-so. Boy, that left me jaded. I also remember him introducing this idea to us, A plus B equals C. Therefore, in all things, A plus B must equal C. And he would spin us in circles about our belief systems and things we knew to be true, so much so that one boy next to me couldn't even tell me what the color red was anymore. He was so confused. And that's exactly what happens when we're left to our own ways. Much like philosophy today, these ancient, historic, and stoic philosophy people are looking at the world and grabbing bits and pieces from every little piece they can get and pasting them together to come up with a belief system. Why is the world the way it is? And we do the same thing. I didn't have a father that was there and present and loved me. Therefore, how can there be a God who is present and loves me? I grew up in a house where everything I did was scrutinized, and therefore I'm going to scrutinize everyone else. You will be that perfect Christian. And if not, well, I want nothing to do with you. Tell me you've been in situations like this. Am I the only one? I hope not. But just like Paul, I believe there's something better. As they're wrestling with what is reasonable and unreasonable, what should they really believe about gods or God? What is human life really all about? And what's our response to it? Paul begins his journey, and Luke captures it in these words in verse 16. Now, while Paul was waiting for them at Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw the city was full of idols. Have you ever just had that experience of a broken heart? I love this opening part because I can tell you in all honesty and truthfulness, there was a night where I was sitting in bed reading a book for one of my seminary classes and I was wrestling. So much so I threw that book across the room because I didn't like what it had to say. I didn't like the traditional church concept. Not because I don't like traditional church, but because I felt like it was missing the mark of providing an opportunity for others to come and experience the greatness of God. And my heart broke. And it was that very night that I feel like God gave me the vision for a church in a mall. Yes, it's crazy, but it's his, not mine, so he's the crazy one. But the same thing happens to Paul as he's looking around Athens and he's seeing these great things like the Parthenon and all these wonderful gods and goddesses, and he's seeing how these people are striving to find which one do you follow and at which time, and how on earth do you appease them all, and what is the meaning of life in all of this? His heart breaks. Because he's seeing the abuse of some of these belief systems. How so much of the idolatry is also tied to some of the sexuality, and how the sexuality is really tied to self-gratification. It's not about love. It's not about sacrifice. It's about me getting mine. And, well, maybe you get yours. It's all about me. And Paul's heart breaks. Listen as Luke continues. So he, Paul, reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons. Paul always starts with the people he knows best, the Jews. And in the marketplace, every day with those who happened to be there. Now the marketplace in those days, they didn't have refrigerators and freezers, so you went daily to get your fresh goods. But think of it at any place. Maybe it's that soccer game, hanging out with parents, or maybe it's those coworkers at work. It's that place where the people commonly gather around and they begin to have conversation about life and everything in it. Paul is there, listening to the people, hearing their thoughts, getting to know them, because his heart is broken. Now hear this, because I've actually kicked two Christian groups out of this mall, believe it or not, for this very reason. They have a great heart of wanting to serve God, but all they want to do is tell everybody how they're blowing it, and they want to hand them a little booklet that will change their life after they've made fun of that person. And they think somehow that is going to capture the heart of God, the character of God. And the problem is they haven't had the experience like Paul did. Their heart is not broken. And therefore they're doing things more out of their own desire instead of God's desire. The beauty of the gospel is it's a message of hope for those seeking hope. When we try to make it about a do it or die, or I'm going to force it upon you, you've missed the idea of the gift. You have cheapened God's grace, and you are robbing people of the true character of God. So stop it. All right, I'm done with that. So every day Paul is talking to these people and his heart is just breaking more and more. And as he sees their different belief systems and their philosophies, he is engaging in such a way that people find him, shocking, a cool guy to hang out with. Heaven forbid if Christians were cool people to hang out with. That means Paul might have been at the pub. I don't know. That means Paul was probably not afraid to hang out with people that maybe had tattoos. Piercings? Paul wasn't afraid. Because when you love somebody, love expels all fear. We hear that throughout the scriptures, don't we? And as Paul is falling more and more in love with these people, his heart is breaking more and more. And as he's getting to know them, he's not just getting to know their belief systems, he's getting to know their names. Because he genuinely cares about them. Well, this, of course, stirs up trouble. Because as he begins to get this following of people that are coming to meet with him daily to ask more questions and to engage in the conversation because he's a great guy, some people show up. Some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him. Now, the Epicurean is an interesting group. They held this theory that according to which the world and the gods we're a long way away from one another. Okay, so their idea is God is so far removed, and we have actually taken this concept today, and it's called the watchmaker. The idea that God set all things in motion like a clock. He wound it up, and then poof, gone. And that's very much what these people believed. Not only were they long away, but there was little to no communication. You couldn't speak with that God because that God wanted nothing to do with you. The result that one should get on with life, the best that one could, is what was left. Just do what you got to do. Discover what you need to do to gain the maximum pleasure out of the world. And then take the bull by the horns. Right? These philosophies are still alive today. When I was a little boy, growing up, I played baseball, and my father was a great baseball player, and I was probably average at best, but I really worked hard, so it made me, like, just slightly above average. And he would always say this to me as I'd walk up to the plate, "Son, be the hero." Well, that's really nice, Dad. You know, he didn't say, "Son, you know, don't suck," or, "Hey, don't strike out." Like, be the hero. And that was great if I got a hit. But you can imagine what happened when I struck out. Or popped out, or grounded out, or was thrown out. All of a sudden, I couldn't be that hero, and I didn't feel like I was enough. So it was all about me doing what I had to do to be enough. Now, the Stoic philosophers, they believed slightly different. They believed that divinity or God lay within all things, all people, all physical things. It's kind of like George Lucas saying, the Force. But again, we can't know this God. We can't really come in contact with him, but we can learn about him if we engage ourselves in the pleasures of this world. If we just gain a little more knowledge, a little bit more experience, we might just arrive at some truth. You know, the number one category of selling books here in America is self-help books. Same idea. 9 steps to becoming totally awesome. How to lose weight. How to be brilliant. It's all about me trying to figure out how to be my own God, because I've got to get mine. If I don't, then I might not be the hero. I might be nothing. And Paul is watching these philosophies destroy lives. So naturally, these two groups come and they begin a conversation. They say, what does this babbler, in the Greek it's word scatterer, what does he wish to say? Others said, well, he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities. Because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. Now we miss this part, but the Bible has some really funny pieces in it. And what's really cool is as Paul is talking in Greek, this word for resurrection is a feminine Greek word. And since they don't really understand the idea of a body being restored back into life, a new life, a better life, a resurrected life, they actually see this funny play on words by Paul, so they think it's Jesus and this really good-looking gal. They want to know this God. Who doesn't want to know the guy that's got the good-looking girl? And so they're kind of going, we're curious. We don't know about this. And they want to invite him to a conversation. They took him and brought him to the Areopagus. And they say this word to him. They say, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting. We want to know about Jesus and this girl. Go ahead and flip the slide. I want you guys to see where they take him. On top of this mountain here. And this is an important place because there was a time in history many years before Paul came where this was kind of the capital. This is where all decisions were made for this territory. But as the Roman government got into more power and the Greek people started to say, well, how are we going to live with this Roman power? They decided that this would no longer have the full authority, that would go to the Roman citizen, but that the authority of all teaching and philosophy and understanding would remain here on this mountain with these philosophers. Remember, the things that give birth here are the things that give birth to people like Plato, Socrates, the modern thought process that we have here in the West was birthed here. Paul has really got himself in some hot water. This is the highest court in the city. It's set on a rock from which one could look down on the famous marketplace across the still more fabulous Acropolis, and they could see the spectacular temples. They could see everything. So not only did they want to be gods, they felt like gods. Paul's invitation to share wasn't so much a matter of, hey, well, there's an interesting fellow. Let's see what he has to say. It was actually more of a slam. Let's bring him up here and let's beat him to death with our philosophy. Let's find out what he's really teaching. And this is important. Because remember Socrates? Socrates was tried and convicted of one of the most horrendous crimes in this area, teaching multiple gods. And they believe Paul, because they don't understand the word resurrection, is talking about multiple gods. This could be a great setup. Not only could they beat him to death with their philosophy, but they could literally put him to death for his philosophy. Now clearly they misunderstood his words, and we're going to get into that in a minute as Paul explains further. So listen to his words as he continues. And they took him and brought him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is that you're presenting. We're curious. For you bring some strange things to our ears, and we wish to know, therefore, what these things really mean. In other words, are you allowed to tell us these secret doctrines, or are they just for you and your select group of people? Are we allowed in? But they're also saying, you know, the reality is, we're going to poke some serious holes in this. So you better have your philosophy all sorted out. You better have it all together. You have no idea what questions we're going to ask. You may even be in danger, though. Because if we can prove not only that your belief system is faulty, we may also be able to prove why you deserve to go to jail and perhaps even die for your belief system. This isn't simply a walk in the park. This is a challenge upon challenge upon challenge for Paul. And I like Paul because he's just too stupid to know when he's in over his head. So he steps in. And I believe he does that not because he's just foolish, but because he understands the character of God. He knows that this God isn't going to put weight on him of whether he wins or loses the argument. This God isn't looking at Paul to say all the right things and, oh my gosh, if he blows it, he's out of the kingdom. He knows that there is nothing that can separate him from the love of God. Even if he were to get it all wrong, there is nothing that can separate him from the love of God. He's fearless. And he steps into this battle. Now all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there would spend their time in nothing except telling or hearing something new. So here's a group of people that gather weekly to talk about the books they're reading, the philosophies they're hearing, the shows they're watching, as if to share something new. And Luke is making this a sarcastic joke to all the readers that will read this in the Greek in the future. He's pointing out that new? There's nothing new. There's nothing new under the sun. In the ancient world, new was not something people wanted. Old was best. Tradition. Everybody knew that. There was nothing new because everything new was novelty. Here today and gone tomorrow. So Luke is pointing out and making fun of this. But if you were interested in temples or idols or every kind of religious cult, then Athens was the place for you. It was better than Vegas. It had everything. Was this simply an opportunity to set Paul up all the more? Or was there really an opportunity for Paul to share hope with these people? Well, Paul wastes no time. Standing in the midst of all of these people, the Areopagus says, "Men of Athens, you know, I've been looking around. I've been listening to your philosophy and your thought, and truth be told, I'm a Roman citizen. I grew up with some of this teaching myself, and I've noticed that there is nobody that builds temples like you. Nowhere in the world are there gods like the gods in which you serve. You seem to be people that really have your stuff together. But I perceive that in every way you are very religious." Very religious. Now, Paul is not simply trying to press buttons or to poke fun or to pull out things from their culture. He's actually getting in with them. Paul's going to start laying the groundwork here to say, you know, I've studied it and I think you're going to like what I have to say. Because I'm going to show you how it fits in. How it answers some of the questions that are left, those gaps in your philosophy. Would you allow me the opportunity with humble heart and humble word to share with you some of my insights? "For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this key inscription, 'To an unknown God.'" Now, unknown seems to imply that perhaps these philosophers desire to remain open, maybe to the possibility that there could even be something for them to learn or know. Maybe there is a God out there worth worshiping. Maybe there's something more to this world that we live in. "To the unknown God, what therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you." He begins explaining the character of God. And he does so in a way that fits into their philosophy and traditions because he wants to answer the questions they're asking. So he opens with this statement, "The God who made the world and everything in it." That means there's no one before him. So as we look through all these gods, all these belief systems, It all had to start somewhere. Let's go there. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And it was out of this incredible Word of God that He spoke creation. And it's out of creation that we see the love of God expelled forth and pushed out into the world. And we see not just creation, but humanity. You're special because God made you special. What a great way to start. I'm sure they're like, let him finish before we attack him. The Lord of heaven and earth does not live in temples made by man. He's bigger than that. He's larger than that. He's the King of kings and Lord of lords. In fact, there is no temple we could possibly make that could contain him. But we do it all the time. Not simply by brick and mortar, but by our own philosophies, our experiences, our wounds. We create temples for this God to live in. Well, God can't be loving because I have not experienced love. A plus B equals C. My mom was so critical. I bet God's just as critical. A plus B equals C. And we do it in all things. Boy, I've never had a good relationship work out in my life, so what would I want with a relationship with this God? It'll probably just go to hell in a handbasket. A plus B equals C. We began forming our own temples, our own structures in which to worship this God that He has no business being in. And the funny thing about our God is He won't remain there. Paul continues, nor is He served by human hands as though He needs anything. This is not a God who simply created us because He was lonely. This is a God who had everything He ever needed existing within Himself, perfection. And it's out of that perfection He can give and be generous. How often in our world do we give and be generous because there's something in it for us? I'm always shocked when we do these blood drives each month, and we'll get a handful of people, and then we do a big one where there's big giveaways, like tickets to somewhere special, and we pack the place. Now, I'd love to pick on those people, but I was in line too because I wanted to get tickets to Cedar Point. What's in it for me? We do the same thing. But what if there's this God that doesn't need us? And it's because He doesn't need us that He now is free to love us where we're at. And because He doesn't need us, we really can't offend Him or push Him away. So therefore, He can shower His love on us simply because He wants to. He doesn't have to. You see, it gets better and better and better. Since He Himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything, we owe Him our lives. But that's not what He demands. He's not looking for a tit for tat or a you owe me. He's looking at us saying, you're my children, and I am so pleased with you. I love you. I have a way for you that will bring you all the desires of your heart. If you'd but just listen to me. This the other night, I'm sitting there with my wife trying to learn how to parent, to be honest with you, and not doing a very good job at it. And my wife and I will do this where we get frustrated. It's like, it's your son, you deal with him. And we're wrestling with my son and my daughter who just clearly want to be their own gods. And we run a pretty heathen household, to be honest. And they made good use of their time. And as we're trying to corral them and get them to do what we want, it kind of dawned on me as I'm sitting there holding a treat for my kids. They're throwing a tantrum about something else. And they're missing out on this treat that I want to give them. They're missing out. And it dawned on me that this is probably exactly how it looks from heaven when I throw my tantrums with God about what I want and not get. God, I know you want to give me everything I need, you know, shelter, food, relationships, love, acceptance, understanding, but I really want a new truck. So, if I can't have a new truck, then, in tantrum. All the while, God is wanting to fill my heart and my life with things that are beyond my wildest imagination, things that truly satisfy, that don't wear out and fall apart, that have to be repurchased or renewed or fixed. But I'm too busy throwing my tantrum. Paul is making a point here that our God is big and our God is love, and that our God wants us to know him the way he already knows us, so that we might reap the blessings. Having determined allotted periods in the boundaries of their own dwelling place, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way towards him and find him. Yet he is actually not far from each of us. Paul's pointing out here that the things that don't always make sense, like these new Caesars that come into rule, that God does appoint seasons and times for such things. That somehow in this crazy mixed up universe of things that don't always make sense, those hard times we go through, God is somehow in the midst. Not necessarily causing them as if there's some big form of karma or, oh, you blew it, so oh, here it comes, it's coming back on you, and oh, tag, you're it, now you've got to deal with this, and oh, it's not about that. But it's about God saying, there is nothing I can't work with. There is nothing I can't bless or redeem or make new or make whole. There's nothing you can do to separate yourself from the love that I want to bestow on you. So deal with it. For in him we live and move and have our being. Not only do we have life and breath from this God, but we get to actually forge and find our identity. Paul's saying, you know, the whole reason you brought me here is so you could beat me up and poke holes in my philosophy. For what purpose? So that you can walk away and feel like you're the tough guy? That you've arrived? That your belief system's better than my belief system? Well, let me just tell you that this God I've been talking about doesn't care about all that. You see, I matter not because of the words I say or the actions I do, but because he says I do. I have incredible worth, so much worth that there's no way to actually put a price on it, because he sent his very son to die for me. You think this battle matters here? You think this argument, this disagreement? Guys, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter what happens here, because God is still God. But I'm trying to share with you the same way I learned that from one beggar to another, I have found some truth and some hope, and I want you to know it. The choice is up to you. But there is always hope, because our identity is in Christ and what he's done for us. That's why there's always new beginnings. There is no choice we're ever stuck in. There is no pattern that we are ever forcefully pushed into. There is nothing that can hold us or contain us. We have freedom if we'd simply rely on it. As even some of your own poets have said, now he begins quoting the great poets of the day. This would be like quoting a song off the radio. Thank God Lady Gaga has not come around yet. Because could you imagine Paul trying to weave that in? Nasty. For we are indeed his offspring. He's talking about the people of this day and age and the stuff that would be on the radio, the things that people are talking about, the things that are in the movies and TVs. These are the words and the messages that even their own philosophers are saying that they're holding on to. That we are indeed the offspring of something. Is it monkeys so that it really doesn't matter? Or is there something bigger in that purpose? Is there a God who puts worth on us that can't be taken away? Being then God's offspring, we ought not to think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and the imagination of man. You can't contain this God. Paul will continually argue with this group of people. Not argue to try to prove his point, to beat them up to win, but argue because his heart is broken for them. And he wants so badly to see them set free in their own philosophy and understanding, to see that this God truly loves them as much as he loves Paul. A few weeks ago, we looked at how Paul made this same argument with some of the Jews that are wrestling with this idea that they are God's chosen people and no one else can be. And Paul says that's an impossibility. For God's message of hope is for everyone, Gentiles and Jews, believers and non-believers. His message of hope goes forth, and we see evidence of it in His Holy Spirit changing hearts and minds. Hope has come to the hopeless. As Paul finishes in conclusion with this group, some will come with him, others will belittle him, and some will stay on the fence. Such is life. Our job is not to convince people to jump from one side of the fence to the other. Our job is to present hope. That we do something with that agnosticism in our own hearts. That since I didn't know a loving God, I must not be able to ever know that there's a loving God. Since I didn't have this understanding of truth in my life, that there is a God who is truth, then I don't need truth in my life. Since I don't truly believe that there's a God who will provide things that I need in this world, in fact, everything I need, then it's all about me getting mine and you getting yours. Our belief matters. But Paul's saying there's a way to be free of that. To find our identity and worth in something far greater than philosophy and thought. So that Christians don't need to be afraid when we engage in conversations with others. That when people have questions, even we have questions about our belief system, we don't need to be afraid. We simply ask them. I close with this story because it's one of my favorites. And it happened a long time ago. There was a young man. You know him as Billy Graham. When Billy Graham started out, he was with another man named Templeton, and Templeton was actually the number one evangelist in the world during that time. They were young men. They had been going from place to place, changing the world with this message of hope, until one day, standing outside an arena, a woman came up to the two and held up a Time magazine cover. On the cover was a woman from Africa holding up her child who had just passed away because there was a drought in that part of Africa. And her question was this: if the God you preach is so loving, then why does he allow this to happen? Templeton shook his head. He said, I don't know. Billy Graham shook his head and said, I don't know. That night, Templeton went back to his hotel room and made a vow that he would never serve God again, one day of his life. Billy Graham that night went up to the mountains, San Bernardino, Southern California, and he opened his Bible on a rock and he cried out to God and he says, I don't have answers for most of the questions people ask me, but I trust you. I'm going to find my identity in you. And even if I can't answer the questions, I know you can. Because I know you to be a God of love, a God of hope, a God of promise, a God who takes care of our needs, a God who cares about those that have been wounded and hurt in this world. And I refuse to believe that what these people believe about you is true. Help me to share your message of hope with them. I think he's been in ministry 70-some years now, preaching the same message, hope. Templeton, by the way, still has remained true to his vow. He has not ever gone back to Christ. And in a recent interview with a reporter who was writing a book called Case for Christ, he met with Templeton and had a conversation. At the end of the conversation, he asked this simple question. He says, what about Jesus? What about Jesus? Templeton, now 80-some years of age, with tears in his eyes, said, I miss him very much. Our belief matters. I don't think Templeton really gave up his belief, but he sold himself short on the hope and the glory that could be his. The same way the Stoics were. And the same reason Billy's heart broke, the same reason Paul's heart broke, is the same reason my heart breaks, and I pray that your heart will break. That there are people that need to be reminded of the hope and the truth that is found in the character of God that is given to us and revealed to us in the Scriptures. May your heart break.